Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Gather Round. Tonight we're talking about the voting age. Is 15 too young to vote? And before we get into that with my wonderful guest tonight, I need to make an announcement. If you're in Chicago or the Chicago area, the Midwest area, please go on Facebook to Chicago 12:12:12 and see what is coming up. There's a 7-day free event series beginning tomorrow night, and it is wonderful. Please check it out. So tonight we have Janet Schmidt, Mike Trout, and Stuart Alexander. And I would like to welcome you all.
Hi, everybody.
Hi. Well, I'm welcoming two people, but Stuart is on his way in, so we're all good. First, why don't we just have each of you say just a tiny bit about yourself. Let's start with Janet.
Oh, I knew you'd call me first. Okay, I don't know what to say about myself. I am politically active. I worked for Governor James R. Thompson's last re-election campaign in Illinois back in the 80s, and I've been interested in politics ever since. I currently host a show here on Blog Talk Radio, a daily show where I talk about news and give my opinion on politics. Right. I'm a writer, active in local politics in southern Illinois near St. Louis, and I don't know, I have a lot of interests and a lot of opinions, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to share them.
Ah, okay, and before the show ends, we'll have everybody give their contact info. Mike, you want to say a little bit about you?
Hi, Roseanne. Well, politically, my first dip into the waters in politics was in 1992. I worked for Jerry Brown for president, his third run for the presidency, and I spent a year in that campaign. I did I was office manager at National Campaign Headquarters. I worked on the Hispanic Outreach campaign, and I worked on the California campaign. And then finally, in the end, there was a delegate to the 92 convention, Democratic National Convention at Madison Square Gardens. And of course, I'm a lifelong Democrat. I ran last year as a progressive independent. I didn't run with the party for the new Congressional District 21 here in Florida on what I consider an original platform.
Right, we're going to talk more about that later, yeah.
Yeah. I was very happy with the results of the election. I got, I'm nobody from nowhere. I got, based on the message, and I got 40,000 votes, so, I'm happy with that. Not 40,000, let's say.
Mike, it's breaking up. It's really breaking up. Is there...
I'm actually in the car. I'm driving through an intersection that's notoriously bad for that. I'll be out of it in just a second. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Now I lost my...
That's much better.
Yeah, it'll go on and out just till I get through this one section here.
Ah, okay. I wanted to say that, and I'm sorry the Stuart's not here right now, but when he comes, he could talk more about it. But recently, I found out that, I guess I had read through it and just didn't pay that much attention, but that one of the parties, one of the socialist parties, is backing the idea of having people vote at the age of 15. And when he mentioned that to me, it was just before we went on the air, and I was like, you got to be blanking kidding me. And So I wanted him to come and talk about that. He did he did not necessarily agree with the 15, but we had a young man on that show who said that he would go with it because he's 19, and he said when he was 15, he wanted to vote. The thing is...
Sure they do, but that doesn't mean they're ready for it.
Exactly. And
I mean they want 15-year-olds want to do a lot of things they're not ready for, and I disagree with 15. I might go with 17.
Right.
Well, my proposal actually is an incremental program.
Can we wait for the proposal?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, because I want to, yeah. So that was something that sort of like raised my hair a bit because I thought, what the hell? You know, a 15-year-old, in my opinion, doesn't know nearly as much as they think they do. And I believe that to vote, you should know a little bit about the world and a little bit possibly about money and things like that. So I mentioned to them that Mike has this other kind of a plan, but I did want to hear, Janet, your thoughts. Now, you're saying that you could see possibly 17.
Well, you know, I have a 15-year-old, and let me preface it with saying I'm not saying this just because I'm a proud mother. I would probably have great faith that my 15-year-old could make an intelligent choice. However, a lot couldn't. And then, you know, I think about it. I know an 82-year-old that can't make an intelligent choice in the election.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk about that later. Right?
I don't know if that's, you know, all of it, but I mean.
Oh, there, you're back. You were breaking up.
Oh, sorry.
That's it. I mean, some kids really know. But, you know, in an ideal world, their schooling would be such that they would learn these things.
Yeah, but we don't live in an ideal world.
But it is,
but
we don't live in an ideal world.
But I was reading something to prepare for the show a little bit, and I found a website called youthrights.org.
Whatever you're doing right now, Janet, keep it, because you were breaking up. But now you
can't. Okay, I guess I had turned in my seat.
Okay.
But on youthrights.org, I mean, I think they have, it seems like an intelligent argument for lowering it to 17. And I guess it's things I hadn't necessarily thought of, that a lot of 17-year-olds do work and pay taxes. And they are subject at the age of 17, and I think every state, to being tried as an adult. They can enter the military now at 17. And so,
Think about, yeah. I mean, if they can, well, that's what they used to say. If they can go and die for the country, they should be able to vote. But now,
right, and that was one of the arguments for lowering it for 18, so the 18, 19, and 20-year-olds could vote in 1971 with the 26th Amendment. That was one of the big arguments that they were draftable. And so,
yeah.
I mean, if they can enter into the military, of course, we don't thankfully have the draft right now.
Right.
Right, but if you think about it, there has to be a substantial number of kids that went to some of these wars and never came back and never got to vote. They were old enough at 18, but they never came home and they never got a chance to vote. So that's another argument for lowering the rate.
Well, I guess I'm one of those people. I'm just holding to the fact that they don't know enough of the world. They don't know how to budget. Most 15-year-olds don't have a clue. They either are given an allowance or whatever. They don't know how to budget it. And I think before they make decisions affecting everyone, that they should know these things.
But then again, we let people vote that are 35 that have no clue.
That. Yeah, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about it, but I'd like for Mike to just tell us his, I think this was very innovative. I had never heard it from anyone else. His take on fractional voting.
Well, that's the whole basis of my proposal. That's called the Civic Act, which is the Citizens Incremental Voting Induction Curriculum. And so the idea is that you start conferring a fractional voting franchise at the age of 14. Now, that doesn't mean that every 14-year-old votes, because the voting cycles don't necessarily correlate with their birthday or whatever. But if someone is 14 and there's an election up, then they would have a fractional voting franchise of, let's say, I think, if I don't have my, of a, like a third of the vote, right?
Well, I thought it was a fifth of them.
They're not getting a full vote, but what you are doing is, you know, these kids are in school and they are studying civics, but at the same time, you know, when you ask them to pay attention to politics and all, you know, a lot of them will tell you, well, hey, why should I? I don't have any say in it. Doesn't matter if I pay attention or not. So that was you know, a good part of my idea with the proposal is you give them a direct line that, you know, you do have a say. And, you know, laws affect juveniles. There's laws that affect juveniles, health laws of juveniles. Like you were saying, the regular criminal law affects juveniles. So, you know, all law affects all of us. So if you start conferring that responsibility to them, but in a fractional sense, like you said, they're not full adults. They're not fully formed. You know, their opinions are neither fully informed or fully formed. So that was the idea with starting it fractionally. Then I realized, you know, since I started that, you know, that there's lots of countries that have started conferring the full vote to 16-year-olds. There's about, according to the resource that I was looking at, about 9 countries, including Brazil and Brazil's new constitution in 1988, I think, they started conferring the full vote, to 16-year-olds. Argentina, just in the last couple of weeks, passed the law conferring the vote to 16-year-olds. Ecuador also recently started the same thing, and like about 6 others, including Austria, you know, some first world countries and some more, you know, developing countries. But I don't think it's such a big scary thing to let kids vote, and I think it's a good idea. You know, hell, we can't get adults to vote, so we need to start encouraging people to vote from an early age. And, you know, let them think that, you know, that their vote does matter, and, you know, in some form.
Well, I could see having children vote on certain issues, possibly. But, I'm just not, I'm not. Now, when I had thought that your fractional voting started with the fifth of a vote, like 14, 15, 16.
It started, I was thinking before, in the 13th year, because, you know, so many, like, cultures and religions, you know, they put that 13th year as a kind of rite of passage into manhood or womanhood or whatever.
Right.
So I had actually started at 13 with a fifth of the vote, and then at 14 with a fourth of the vote, and then it goes to a third at 15. At 16, it was a half. At 17, it was 7/8. And, of course, at 18, they have the full franchise.
Do you have a petition on change.org about this? Is this yours, the Civic Act?
Yes, yep, that's
all right, because on this it says at 14 they would get 1/3 of the vote, at 15
yeah,
a half, 5/8 at 16, 7/8 at 17,
well,
and 18.
That sounds convoluted. Why couldn't you start out 14 with 1/5, at 15 with 2/5, 16 3/5? 17.
Yeah, those are all details that absolutely could be debated, and, you know.
Well, that'll never pass, because I think fractional voting or giving a fraction to anyone is never going to fly in this country, because, at one point we had fractional.
Right.
We counted people fractionally when the Constitution was entered in terms of representation, and I think that brings back a very negative connotation, so I don't see how that's ever going to be sold to the majority. I don't like it. And, you know, like you said, I'm not going to I would not want a 14-year-old to vote. A lot of 14-year-olds.
See, I wouldn't mind if a 14-year-old voted and got 1/5 of the vote.
But I could see at that age being much more subjective to their parents,
well, of course,
instead of making a free, informed choice.
Part of your civic education, you know, is, you know, the vote belongs to you. This fifth of a vote belongs to you, and you know, you should think carefully about what you're voting for, and, you know, these are the issues. And, you know, we have the problem now that all our electioneering and all our politics revolves around money. So
right.
whether or not we're going to beat that, you know, whether or not we're going to turn back the tide of Citizens United, you know, I don't know. I know the people right, left, center want, you know, I think I've had enough of that, you know. So as you, what do you replace that with? What do you replace the money with? But my feeling is that you replace it with what was at the heart of democracy in history, which was debate. So if, you know, if we had a politics that was more centered around debate, then I would feel more comfortable with, you know, with everybody's vote. Not, you know, not Jews' vote, but with everybody's vote. But instead, you know, now it's all geared towards, you know, the name recognition, and generally that's from the duopoly from the red or the blue side, which, you know, have the biggest machines to turn out the most money and control the, you know, control all our politics.
Well, sure. We know there's so many things wrong with our system. And what I hear where Janet's coming from as far as the fractional voting, but I think that this is different because we're saying, you know, a certain age of youngsters. But she and I have had extensive conversations about literacy tests, which, again, we think is never going to happen in this country again. However, that doesn't mean that it would be wrong.
No, I mean, ideally, I mean,
I don't like the literacy at all. It's just like a poll test. Yeah, I wouldn't want that.
Stupid people voting, okay?
But then again, I was talking, I don't know if I, Ruthie, I don't know if we talked about this. A couple weeks ago, I found online the citizenship test that someone who moves to the United States and wants to become a citizen has to take. And it's 96 questions. To pass this and become a citizen, one only needs 58 right, which I think is horrid.
Yeah,
but I mean, that's bullshit. Half of it, because these are not hard questions. I think anybody who participates in democracy should know these. And I have been stunned since taking that. Now, by the way, I say this, I got a 96. I didn't think it was very hard. And I did give it to my 15-year-old who's been homeschooled, cold. And she got 100. I was so proud. But and they, you know, and I think, okay, people who come into our country have to know who the Speaker of the House is and who is third in the succession. But it's stunning to me how many native-born American citizens don't know who the Speaker of the House is or where he is in the he or she is in the succession. They think would get it confused with Secretary of State, and what are cabinet positions, and what are some of the issues? And so I just wonder, I mean, one of the issues that during the Jim Crow era, when, you know, some of the southern states or all of them had the poll taxes and the literacy tests, they were very arbitrarily given. There was, you know, a white person came in and was registering to vote, and they'd say, like, what color is the sky? A black person came in and they might say, you know, what is the entire 13th Amendment in, you know, or what, you know, memorize the whole Bill of Rights and explain each thing.
Turn again. You were breaking up.
Okay. I didn't move, but maybe I move around a little bit when I talk. Sorry. And I'll try to hold on to the desk so I don't move.
It's breaking up. It's breaking. Huh.
Okay,
but right, they were asking them questions that would be very hard for anyone.
Exactly, or to spell words that are, like, you know, amazing. And if you had one standard test, and then then the other issue I go with that is you would almost have to have this every 4 years or 2 years, so people are up on things. I was struck, and you know, I've complained to you about this all of this last election cycle. A family member very close to me is a Republican.
Right.
And they were voting for Romney. And they had no reason. They had no clue. They didn't know who Paul Ryan was. They didn't know anything about Mitt Romney other than he was a handsome white man. I'm serious. That was the, you know, because I said one day, I'd love to understand why you're voting Republican. You know, because I'd like to know. Maybe I'm wrong, and you can convince me. And they said, sure. And they go, I go, why are you voting for Romney then? Because I like him. Okay. Well, what do you like about him? And they had no answer, because the only answer was he's white, and they knew that would
not
fly with
me. Right, he's not black. And family member wasn't going to say that, but that's all we could figure out.
Yeah, because she wouldn't say, and I'm like, okay, you know, and this is a person who regularly forwards the anti-Obama stuff and has not even stopped with the election. But, no, so I don't know. I mean, it would be, You know, a 14-year-old, could they make it? Could they make this decision? We don't trust 14-year-olds to make decisions about their own health care or their own life. They can't sign a contract. So that would be an argument not to lower it. But, I mean, I don't know. I could see 17. I can go with that. I mean, I see the argument.
I could probably go with 17. And I could go with, if we were doing fractional, like one-fifth of a vote for a 14-year-old, because I think, okay, this is getting them into some kind of good practice. But I would not give a 14- or 15-year-old, and I'd have to think hard on 16-year-old, a full vote.
Well, the 9 countries that have lowered the age to 16, they're giving them the full vote right at 16. So,
right.
I mean, if the debate, you know, panned out that, yes, we were going to do that, then I would still, even if, you know, let's say we can get the whole world to give everybody the full vote at 16, then I would still say it's a good idea to give a fractional vote at 14, you know, make it what, you know, like you're saying, you know, like in my proposal, start with a fifth of a vote or something. The idea being not that that's really going to influence the vote. Like in Brazil, I think it amounted to a total of 1.5 to 2% of the whole electorate, you know, for the 16-year-old.
Right, okay.
So even a fraction of that, I mean, they're not going to have, you know, it's not like a major voting block. But at the same time, the most of the idea is not for them to, you know, decide what happens with the country. The idea is to, you know, make a path that draws that line from civic education to civic participation.
Right, to get them used to it and used to having a voice. I can see that.
That's really the most thing, because it's certainly not about conferring any great power to them. You know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you bring up a good point about, you know, getting people involved and engaged. I was thinking about that today while I was pondering the show, and I had an idea. This just occurred to me today, so I'm flying it here first.
All right.
Okay. we really need, I mean, I'm a precinct committeeman, and our voter turnout, I'm lucky to get like 34% of turnout. And that is considered a really high turnout in the county I live in. And that's friggin' pathetic. What if we rewarded voters, okay? You meet all the requirements and you vote, but what if, you know, like when you do your income tax at the end of the year, you somehow there will be proof of voting, whether it is just the IRS could check Social Security numbers with the voter registration, and you get a nice little, you know, a tax credit. Not a deduction.
I don't really like that, but I'll tell you, in some countries, they have obligatory voting. You know, I like that better. Every able-bodied person, every literate able-bodied person, actually they do have a literacy test on those. Every literate able-bodied person from 18 to 70, I think is in Argentina, is obliged to vote.
They don't let people over 70 vote?
Well, what bothers me about it being an obligation or being rewarded, does that make people actually think before they vote, or do they just vote to get?
Well, see, there is a – I don't know how that would be solved.
Right. Yeah, I'm not necessarily advocating it. I'm just putting it out there as a, you know, as a point of observation.
Now, I just thought of that today. I thought, wouldn't it be cool, you know, if you would – I think we could dramatically increase turnout. But then again, with that, I would like to see, as we've discussed before, a standardized voting rules and laws for that all 50 states.
I actually think that that test that you found that citizens – or to become citizens have to take, I don't think that it would be requiring too much that people at least pass it.
Now, theoretically, we have a law in the state of Illinois that when children are in school at the ages of eighth grade and at the ages of high school to graduate, they're supposed to pass, not really, they call it a constitution test. It's basically on the constitution, and that, again, is not a real hard test. And they're required in Illinois to have at least one unit in high school of American history, which isn't very much.
And you memorize the preamble, right?
I don't think they do that anymore. I mean, but I mean, they have to pass the test. And,
okay.
But I mean, I would just see this, I don't know, the citizenship test. I mean, just because you were born here, why should you get a pass on knowing these questions? And it's not that hard. You know, it has questions like, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. Maybe I should Google it and get a few and see if we know them.
Yeah, well, I just think that it says a lot for your homeschooling your daughter, the fact that she got 100% on it.
Oh, I was proud. I mean, I really did not think she would. I honestly didn't think she would do that, you know.
Yeah.
But I was very, okay, is this, I'm trying to find one. Official online citizen practice test.
But, I mean, I guess I don't trust our school systems enough to think that, and some parents teaching their kids along with the school, I don't trust them enough to give the vote to young kids. But, like, if we're
right.
talking fractions at 14, 15, we're just teaching them about voting. And, you know, it could be in school, it could be like a class affair.
Mm-hmm. Or, all right, here's a few of the sample questions, and there's just a few. Why does the flag have 13 stripes? And these are multiple choice. Because there were 13 original colonies, because the stripes represent the 13 Indian tribes, because the nation was founded on July 13th, and because there were 13 founders.
Okay, that is...
That is actually a real question on the United States citizenship test.
Wow. They're all multiple choice?
They all are multiple choice.
Okay,
who is the commander-in-chief of the military?
Oh, my God.
It gives you choices like VP, President, Speaker of the House, Secretary of State. Name one problem that led to the Civil War, presidential conflicts, human rights, election freedom, or slavery. Why does the flag have 50 stars? Because there are 50 terms in the Code of Independence. Each star represents a state. Because there are,
You just gave me another idea. How about if the kids take that test and any of them that can't pass it, we take the voting rights away from their teachers?
Well, and then here's the thing, though. I mean, honestly, these kind of questions, when is the last day you can send in federal income tax forms? What are the two major political parties in the United States?
Okay, so
who wrote the Declaration of Independence?
Brain surgery questions.
You need 58 of those to win.
Okay, that is appalling.
That is appalling. That's barely, I mean, I would, if I were grading it, 58 on that would be an F.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I would not pass some, my daughter would not have passed it with 58. And like I said, it was 100. I mean, there's another question. It does go into some history. Who did the U.S. fight in World War II?
Okay, just a little bit of history in there. Okay.
Yeah, and so, but I mean, and you know, you may off the top of your head think I don't remember, but when you see the question, you think, yes, of course, it was Japan, Germany, and Italy.
So you've got multiple choice. So truthfully, I don't think that type of a literacy test, you know, quote unquote, I do not see anything wrong with that. With requiring something like that, because at least you feel that the people have somewhat a little bit of knowledge.
Right. And a basic understanding, like, you know, knowing when taxes are due, knowing who the two political parties are, and it's not Republican and Socialist, although that is on this sample test, which I'm sure a lot of people might answer that.
right now.
What is one promise you make when you become a U.S. citizen?
What are my choices?
To be loyal to the country you were born in.
One of the reasons that those literacy tests were, you know, those poll tests were beat down back in the day, you know, for I guess, you know, African Americans, was, I suppose, one of the arguments was that voting is a right. You know, once you're of whatever voting age is, which, the you know, which like is established in, you know, in the Constitution or by amendment, then it becomes a right. So I don't know if any of those tests would pass muster based on those arguments.
No, there would have to be a law, but there, you know, like when we had the Jim Crow era, the states are allowed to make, and this is true today, each state has their own election laws, And the states were allowed to have a literacy test until it was overturned that they couldn't have one. Now, it would have to take, and I think, an act of Congress and perhaps an amendment that this would be done. But as I talked to Ruthann one time, if we had a federal panel, like let's just say there's an organization called the League of Women Voters, which for quite a few years ran the presidential debates. A group like that is politically neutral, it is bipartisan, to come up with the questions or to, you know, like I said, just take the citizenship test.
I like just taking the citizenship test because...
Although, again, you know, it doesn't say that the person is going to understand if they vote for, like, for example, the person voting for Mitt Romney doesn't admit they have, you know, they're not going to quiz them on it whether they have any knowledge of what the Republican platform is.
Right.
Exactly. What's the legislative agenda you're voting for, you know?
Right.
And, that should be what we do vote for is a legislative agenda, but a lot of people don't vote for legislative agendas. They vote for, you know, the red color or the blue color.
They vote for personality a lot. And
personality, yes, yes.
And that's...
Well, or the platform of, like, you know... pro-life or, you know, whatever they feel it is, you know. So, I don't know.
So what would be the answer? I mean, if we can't have a literacy test, what can we do to educate the students? Because obviously our public schools, I mean, I'm sorry, and I can't blame the teachers, because some of them are so overworked and underpaid, but our public schools are not exactly doing a great job.
I don't know. You know, I think that there's they point a lot of fingers at school system at performing, you know, underperform. But by and large, across the whole United States, you know, and not just the 23 major cities or however many there are.
Mike, I can barely hear you. Janet, can you hear him? Is it just somebody?
No, I can hear him quite well.
Okay. It's my end then. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I would say by and large, we you know, our school system does perform pretty well. And there's a lot, you know, news people run after, you know, fire, you know, flames and blood, you know. So anytime there's a bad story, it gets blown up, you know, to all proportions. But I would say by and large, throughout the country, we have a pretty good educational system. Yeah, elementary, you know,
don't.
I have to disagree. I'm in Illinois.
Oh, absolutely.
And
I mean,
they
teach to the test. They don't teach students to think.
Right.
And that's one reason why even though we are Democrats, we homeschool.
Even though you're at your home school, that's always funny when you say
you
that.
You have no idea the grief I've gotten over that. I've been called a rhino because, obviously, if you homeschool, you must be a fundamental Christian.
Yep.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like, okay, and I don't know.
You have the computer right in front of you there. I wonder, Janet, if you pulled up to the question how do Finland and U.S. schools compare? For 26 comparisons.
I'm sorry,
Finland.
To what?
Finland.
Greenland or Finland?
Finland.
Finland, okay.
There's just an article, I was just reading it last night, and it was about the 26 major differences between the Finnish educational system and the United States educational system. And it was pretty interesting because what you were just saying about teaching to the test. Well, they're saying, you know, they don't do any testing of any student really till they're 16. And then it's, you know, it's just sort of a general, let's check out how the whole country is doing.
I read something about that recently. Maybe it was something you posted, Mike. Everybody
Post it because I post, you know.
I'm scanning it. It's a very interesting article.
Probably did post it.
Yeah, I mean, some places don't teach to the test, and I admire them.
They perform higher, you know, than a lot of their counterparts, you know, in the end. I guess, you know, obviously when they say they perform higher, I guess there's a test for that in the end. But
Well, there is, but here's what it said. It said in 2000, the Finns surprised the world when their 15-year-old scored at the top of a closely watched international exam called the PISA, the Program for International Student Assessment. Finland has stayed near the top ever since, while the U.S. scores around the middle. And they say that, you know, their head of Ministry of Education and Culture was in Seattle this week to share the story of the Finland's success. And he said his message, although he is too polite to put it so bluntly, stop testing so much, trust teachers more, give less homework, and actually, believe it or not, shorten the school day.
Wow.
Finland, in other words, has become an educational star by doing the opposite of what's happening in many U.S. districts and schools. And you know what I would have to say, you know, like I said, we homeschool. I'm not a real anal person. She's not sitting at her desk from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Right.
Learning is an ongoing thing. I mean, there may be days we don't, quote-unquote, officially do school, but learning takes place. And I would argue maybe more learning takes place on those days. And then she turns around and she can pass that test. She can do all kinds of different things she's been given. And, you know, so I do know where she needs some, you know, she needs to be working on a few things. But by and large, she knows a lot more than I would argue the average 15-year-old in my community knows.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think that's right, you know.
And, of course, I think you said it before, Janet, is that, you know, your kids probably do follow their parents' habits, and you're politically aware, so you know when you're watching your channels or reading your resources, she's probably got that extra bit of motivation from picking up your habits, which is a great thing.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Wow, I'm going to get this book though, Finnish Lessons, that the Minister of Education has written about. Wow, it sounds great. So thanks for telling me about that. I had missed that article.
Yeah, very interesting. They get 75 minutes of recess compared to 27 minutes of U.S. schools average.
Wow.
Yeah, a shorter school day.
Now, another important thing is the depth of knowledge that the teachers have over there. They're required to have a master's degree. You're required to have a master's degree to be a teacher. And, for instance, last year there were 660 vacancies for which they had 6,600 applications. So they had 10 times as many applicants, and all of them with the master's degree. And, of course, they got their master's degree through, you know, public education, too, because they pay through their taxes. But
exactly.
Education goes all the way through higher education. It's free.
Yeah. Exactly.
So I'm trying to decide if I can afford to go to college. It's, you know, decide if you want to because, you know, it's there.
Right. Well, that's it. I mean, that's the whole thing about any kind of socialism in education. I mean, education is free. And it used to be free or very close to it in this country. But now you graduate from college, these 22, 23-year-olds, they have a debt of $150,000.
Yeah.
You know, that they're paying it off till they're 50.
We're not making that investment in our future because those are, you know, they will be the people, you know, running the show and, you know,
yeah,
in how many years, you know, but they will be running the show. So, I mean, we're really behind on that whole curve.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the Scandinavian countries seem way ahead of us in a lot of ways, not just education, but as far as maternity and paternity leave for, you know, the newborns, their parents, up to a year or something for both of them.
Medical care.
You know, all of that kind of thing. And
they have family vacations. They have family vacations. They get most of Europe gets at least start with like four weeks of vacation, and I think it goes up to like 6 weeks of vacation a year, you know.
Huh. I mean, here, most jobs, now we do have a friend who works at a nonprofit, and he gets something like 6 weeks. And he has, but most people don't. I mean, a friend of mine gets a week paid, and then he can take another week without pay.
Mm-hmm. My husband will have 10 years on the job in January, and he will, at that time, he will finally have 3 weeks.
Isn't that's ridiculous? And I mean, he
although they don't want him to tech more than a week at a time.
Yeah, right. So he's going to have 3 weeks, but he can't like take. That's ridiculous. That is.
And a full time job in Germany is 35 hours a week, and they're one of the most highly productive economies in the world. You know.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, just putting in more hours does not necessarily mean that the production is any better.
Right.
There's a thought around, it's called automation socialism, and they're talking about, you know, because a lot of people say, well, we can't have all these, they talk about factories and the mechanical things now that take, you know, this thing has been put in place and it takes the job of four people. But what they're talking about is, well, that's okay because those four people will still work 2 hours a day, which is all it's going to require to run all of these things. So, you know, that's down the road and that's not a bad idea. It's something to look at. Because then
if society adjusts to the technology, then that's great. But,
right.
You know, I was talking to somebody, you know, all our farming, you know, could be basically fully automated. Well, once that's done, and nobody has a job, how do you decide who gets to eat? So society has to adjust to that technology, you know.
Exactly. But I don't think it would be that hard because, you know, you would just be working, you know, 8 or 10 hours, whatever, a day, a week. And there's so many things that people could do in this extra time,
dedicate themselves to science and dedicate themselves to the arts, themselves to, you know, other problems, other pressing problems that we have, education, healthcare.
Right.
You know.
Their families. I mean, now so many people in America are working, if you have a couple together, they're working 3 to 5 jobs between them. They're never able to be with each other or their children. So, you know, that would be alleviated. But, I mean, that's just a whole, we're talking about a lot of things down the road. I did want to ask both of you about the Electoral College views and what can we do about it.
We need to get rid of it.
Okay.
I'm for the popular vote, of course.
Yeah, I think it worked. I think it was a good idea when they did it, but it has long outlived its purpose. And we should go to a direct popular vote. And, you know.
And also, what about, if going to that conversation, what about instant runoff elections? So that people don't have to say, you know, my vote is wasted. You know, my first choice is Jill Stein and my second choice is Barack Obama.
Yeah,
you know, so that, you know, people never have to feel like their vote is going to be wasted.
As long as, I mean, I would hate to see a time when, like, say we vote online, and I see that as being a good idea. Everyone has a Social Security number. There could be a way to make it one vote, one person.
Right, you can just be on that.
But,
it could be secure, yes, it could be secure, you're right.
Yeah, I would not want to see a ballot with, say, 20,000 candidates for president because anybody, can, you know, we still need to have some standards and some qualification and some process to get on the ballot. Maybe not as we have it now where every state has a different criteria, so we do have candidates that can't, third-party candidates that can't get on every ballot, but have something to prevent, you know, I could just see a mess with that. But, yeah, I agree in runoff and say we have, you know, qualified candidates that meet certain national criteria, that it would be uniform, and then again, the idea that they have to raise so much money to get on the ballot in Illinois and then turn around and raise a ton of money to get on the ballot in
somewhere
Florida
else
or California. Yeah. No, get rid of that.
Yeah.
But have something.
That's what I think. We have to bring debate back to the center of politics. You know, it has to be debate. And I don't have a problem with there being, with running against 100 people. In this last election I ran against an incumbent and another independent challenger. And lo and behold, the incumbent wouldn't debate me until a week before the election. He finally said, "Okay, if you can send it up, I'll debate you." You know, and back when I started, that was I really didn't think I was going to face that. I really didn't think it through. But you know, as a you know, as incumbents are notorious for not wanting to debate.
Right.
So I think we have to put into codify into law that if you're running against somebody and there's a, you know, there's a challenger, and if you get challenged to debate, that you have to accept at least so many one-on-one debates for whatever that office is that you're running for. Because
actually,
if the people
that's
are
not a bad idea. Yeah, I mean, if you're going to run, you should be able to debate, even if you would be a lousy debater. I guess you need to learn then. I do want to take a call from my friend Jordan. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hey. So you've been listening?
I've been listening for a few minutes, just on the phone, and then a little bit on the radio. I heard you discussing Scandinavia, and also I heard the beginning of the discussion about the Electoral College.
Right. So what are your thoughts on these things, especially the Electoral?
Well, in terms of elections, I think that, yeah, like you said, the Electoral College was a good idea when they founded it, because it would have been, because of the technology at the time, it would have been nearly impossible to count all of the votes,
right,
you know, across the entire country. So it made sense to do it by state. But now that we have the technology to do that, it doesn't really make any sense anymore. And I also heard the other gentleman,
Mike
was speaking on sort of what did you call it, like a ranking system, so that you can vote and not feel like your vote is wasted.
So they call it instant runoff. So you put your first choice, your second choice, you know, your third down to, I don't know, you know, however many choices they make it, though they allow, you know, that you determine should be allowed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a number of different ways that would allow for more ideas and more parties to be in the system, and therefore be more representative of the people, as opposed to just two parties. And in terms of presidential elections, France has this thing where they have two elections, basically, one where everybody runs, and they take the top two candidates, and this allows for a greater number of parties to get votes. And
yeah,
what they do is they take the top.
It's a runoff election, but it's not an instant runoff election. They have to have one candidate end up with more than 50% of the vote, I think, is how they do it in France. So that second election is between the two, and then one of those, you know, I guess presumably still has to get more than 50%, but if it's just between two, unless it's a dead tie, one of them is going to be more than 50%.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And for instance, in Norway, they actually don't run specific candidates; they just run parties, and basically,
really?
You know, the entire population votes on the party that they prefer, and each party gets to put a certain number of candidates into the parliament based on, so if the Socialist Party gets 20% of the votes, the Socialist Party gets to put 20% of the candidates in there. If the Labour Party gets 40%, the Labour Party gets to put 40%. If the Conservative Party gets 20%.
If they candidates, are those candidates they put in, or those are appointees of the party?
They're generally appointees of the party.
Okay.
Aren't they candidates, like, you know, like in our case, I equate them to like senators or representatives, and if the Democrats win, they would pick politicians. They're probably not going to go pick, you know.
Yes. Right. But the way this turns out to be beneficial is that there's seven or eight parties represented in the Norwegian parliament.
Wow.
And you know, the Democrats here are pretty much the same as their Conservative Party, and then our Republicans would be called there. They have it called the Progress Party, which is the loopy Conservatives.
That's funny, but anytime Conservatives are called the Progress Party,
I would imagine that there's, if there's all those different parties, then they probably each have their own unique approach to how they appoint the people they would put in also.
Yes, absolutely. But the ruling party generally that gets the most votes in Norway is the Labour Party, which is significantly left of the Democrats here.
Right.
Jordan has just done a major study on Norway, so he's right up. He knows what's happening there.
That's great. Well, they do a lot of things right there. That's for sure.
Yeah, I don't know, Jordan, if you heard Mike.
Jordan, are you the one that was going to come on and talk about the youth vote? Are you the one that was going to come on and talk about the youth vote?
No, Jordan, that's what we should ask you. We've got 9 minutes. What do you think about lowering the voting age?
You know,
we're talking about WAVO, like 14, 15, 16. What do you think?
You know, I really don't necessarily see a need to lower the voting age. At 16, I might have been interested in voting, but I mean, I don't see whether it would be beneficial or harmful to lower it. Obviously, I don't think that the voting age should be raised, but
right.
I don't really have a strong opinion with any fact base to really have any thoughts on that. But
right,
in terms of...
A resource I was looking at last night, there's about 9 countries that have lowered the voting age to 16. There's Austria, Brazil, Ecuador, Argentina just lowered it, like, within the last couple of weeks. There's some country called Jersey, which I didn't know there was a country called Jersey. But there's about 9 countries that have lowered the full voting age to 16. And we were talking about my proposal, which is called the Civic Act, which is to confer a fractional voting franchise to youth, to draw a direct line from civic education to civic participation. And, you know, it basically starts with, once somebody's, completed their 14th birthday, they'd have a third of the vote. When they're 15, they'd have a half vote. When they're 16, they'd have 5/8 vote. When they're 17, they'd have a 7/8 vote. And of course, when you're 18, you get the full vote. And so part of the topic of tonight, we were talking about, you know, the youth vote and various ways that it would be approached. And
okay, that's very interesting.
It'd be sort of like a training kind of thing for the ones who are quite young. I mean, and it wouldn't amount to a huge voting block, but it would be something that maybe would encourage people then to go on and vote as they got older. And then Janet had suggested possibly some type of reward for people voting. This was not necessarily the youth vote, but on their income tax, when, you know, some way of checking, and if they voted, they would get some type of a rebate or something.
Tax credit.
So
that's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, obviously, voting in this country in democratic participation is extremely low.
Well, that was our other thing. Would people vote just for anybody, just so they would get this tax credit, or like?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Mike was talking about obligatory voting in some countries, but there again, is it just because they have to, so they just go and check whatever without thinking? I mean, I would like for people who are voting to have a grasp of what is at stake.
I think that one thing that does need to be changed if we want to increase democratic participation is the registration process. Citizens should be registered at birth, and whatever the voting age is when they reach that, they'll be able to vote without registration.
Okay.
I'm on that.
That's something.
What did you say, Mike?
I don't have a problem with that. I mean, the voting is right. You know, it is a right. So,
Well, you would have to have some way to prove people aren't voting multiple places. And I'm sorry, I missed it. I just got some disturbing news while we're on the air. But, I mean, how would you ensure that, you know, somebody didn't vote six times?
Right. Well, we have to have it has to be secure. But we can
do
that.
Use social security numbers is my personal thought, but...
Right, social security numbers. It would run along with social security numbers. And, for instance, in Venezuela, they track their voting in three ways. They track their voting by doing a physical paper drop box, a computer electronic tracking system, and also using their thumbprint.
Mm.
Wow.
The voting system, and so Fox News running around saying that Chavez's victory was corrupt is absolutely absurd, because the voting system in Venezuela, even recognized by the Carter Center, which is not a socialist organization
the Carter Center said that it was probably the most honest elections in the world.
They said it was probably one of the cleanest elections in the world. That's exactly what they said.
And so it's those three things, Jordan. Okay, right. Mm-hmm. So wow.
And that's actually it was the Carter Center article that I learned about these three, the tracking system that they had, and the three-step process.
Now that's excellent. Wow. So we've got like 4 minutes left. Everybody want to sum up something? Janet, you want to begin? And tell us your contact info for this show or whatever you want to give out.
Okay, well, I have a show here on Blog Talk Radio at 11 a.m. Central every day, Coffee Break with Janet Schmidt. It's also under On the Air with Janet Schmidt. I have a Facebook page, Janet Schmidt, and also Barefoot Domestic Goddess, which encompasses everything I do. and I may have more in the future, but that's it. And I think it's been an interesting discussion.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on, and thanks to Mike and our
great
caller.
Great talking to you, Janet.
Yeah, nice talking to you.
Mm. And Mike, what would you like to sum up with?
I mentioned before, I was a candidate in the last cycle. I don't know if I'm going to be a candidate in the next cycle, but as far as contact information, my campaign website is still up at voteforTrout.com. Vote with either the number 4 or the word spelled out, F-O-R. Either way, goes right to the website. And, of course, my legislative agenda, which includes the Civic Act, which is the incremental voting thing. But, you know, I have the top 9 or 10 proposals, you know, and I think they're mostly about good government. And, you know, I just like to keep talking about those things. So anybody interested, voteforTrout.com.
Okay, and Jordan, our caller, Jordan Scott from Chicago, well, living in Chicago now, what would you like to finish us with?
Oh, I just wanted to touch real quick on the idea of literacy tests for voters.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I mean, literacy should be a concern of the government, because we should be trying to reach full literacy, full 100% literacy rate, but literacy tests for voters, absolutely not.
Did you hear us when we were talking about it?
No.
No. Okay, because you and I will talk about that later. I mean, what we were suggesting is the citizenship test that's required for people to take, that possibly be given. It's 96 questions of multiple choice, and to become a citizen, you only have to get 58 of them. We're just
so easy, they should have to get 100. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I grew up with a lot of immigrants, and the impression that I got of the test is that it's very difficult.
Really? You can Google it. Look up the U.S. citizenship test, and there are a number of sites where you can try it. And I'm sorry, I thought it was very easy. And my 15-year-old passed it cold without studying. So with 100% on her score.
For immigrants because of the language barrier.
Yeah,
I would say.
But then again, if they can't do the language well enough to pass this test, they are going to have a hard time being a citizen in this country. So maybe that is something they need to have a certain level of literacy. And
well, here's the thing. Here's the thing is that in Scandinavian countries, they provide 500 hours of free language training for any immigrant.
Great, we should do that. I like that. I mean, I have no problem with that here. But
all immigrants. I think immigrants come here and they want to and they try to learn the language, and it's a lot harder usually for the first generation that, you know, grew up on their one home language. But by the second generation, you know, you have full American U.S.
English. You know that 500 hours of free language training? I love it. But
that's a great idea.
I want to thank everybody. Janet, Mike, Jordan, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I learned a lot. So I always like that. Thank you.
Can I stay on and listen to the next show?
Sure.
All right. Now I will for a while.
Girls in Iowa, they found their bodies this afternoon. Hunters found their bodies. The last day of hunting season.
And welcome to 30 Minutes with Michael Staples. Guess what? Today, we're turning the tables, and Michael is answering the questions. Hello, Michael.
Hey, everybody. How's everyone doing this evening?
So how's it feel? You're going to be on the other end. It feels
a little weird. I'm used to at this moment saying, you know, welcome everyone to 30 Minutes, blah, 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 and giving my little spiel. So it feels a little awkward being on the other side of it, but I'm excited.
Okay.
I'm excited, and actually I'm kind of angry at the moment, too. Not angry about this situation, but I had the bad mistake of watching the news this evening, and it just infuriated me from beginning to end.
What did I miss?
Well, they are talking again about what's happening in Syria and how Assad is poised to maybe use chemical weapons against his own people like Iraq did. So based on that maybe scenario, we should just go in there right now and take them out.
Right, and we have the USS Eisenhower with 8,000 troops right off the shore.
Yeah, poised and ready to go. And, you know, the whole situation I just can't take it anymore. All this warmongering going on by the United States in the Middle East and around the world, I can barely even speak about it. It makes me so angry.
Well, I don't quite, I don't know. I don't understand how we just have not learned anything from the past.
Well, what we've learned is that the Defense Department and the Pentagon wants to keep us perpetually at war because it keeps them perpetually in business.
Right,
and that's the only thing they've learned, and it's an old tale that's been going on for years and years, really as long as I've been alive, and that's, you know, quite long enough. And you know, it's the only way it's ever going to change is when the people of the United States say enough is enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's not just going to be in, you know, sending an email or two to their state representatives. It's going to be when the American people take to the streets the same way the Egyptians are taking to the streets now in Cairo.
Right. And I mean, I just the idea of that happening is scary.
It is scary. It is scary, but, you know, the people in Washington that, unfortunately, even though they've been elected in to represent us, they are not representing us. They are not there for our interests at all. They're there for their own interests or for corporate interests or for government interests, but they're not representing the American people. And, they, you know, as far as I can tell, they don't really give a crap what the American people think or want or even need.
No. I agree. For whatever reason.
For money.
They're supposed to be working for us.
that they're working against us.
They're not, yeah. And, I mean, that's just, I don't know really what to do about it. I mean, we want to fire them for sure.
That's what I want, you know, and that's another thing that we need. I mean, it's not just enough to elect new representatives that, you know, go in with great campaign ideas and great campaign speeches about how, you know, they're going to work for the constituents and they're going to work to change Washington, because it seems like as soon as any new representatives get in there, within no time, I mean, probably within their first year of service, they're already, like, wrapped up in the system, you know, and already they're not doing what they promised to do.
Right.
So it's like, it's almost like we need a clean slate. You know, they do, in fact, they need to all be fired. We need to clear the place out and, I don't know, start fresh. I mean, it sounds absurd. I'm sure it will never happen, certainly not in my lifetime, but that is what we need. We need a fresh start.
Well, I'm hoping for it. well, so you were going to talk a little bit. We talked about this, about the presidential election and what you thought. Do you think it made any kind of a difference?
You know, I think in a sense it made a difference, because this election, I feel like more people actually got involved about the election and were interested in the election and followed the election. I think more than, you know, maybe any election in quite a number of years, maybe since Kennedy. And unfortunately, the president we have is nothing like Kennedy. But I do like that so many people got involved and so many people went out and actually voted and tried to make a difference, even though the person that we got isn't making much of a difference.
Okay, so you just say that more people were involved than have been in a while. So
I think so. I think probably more people went out and voted this time around than have voted in quite a long time. I mean, the numbers really showed that, and it was really interesting too to see how the Republican Party has realized during this past election that they are just completely out of touch with the American people. I'm no fan of the Democrats or the Republicans, but it was just really interesting that they went into this election cycle kind of believing that the landslide would be in their favor. I mean, they kind of thought it was a no-brainer, and maybe it could have been, but they're not talking to the American people, not the majority of Americans. It seems like their message is to that one percentile.
Yeah. Sure. The people who are funding them. Briefly, because I know that you have some major thoughts about this, would you just talk to us a little bit about the Palestinian genocide? I'm just cheering you up,
like,
all over the place tonight, aren't I?
No, it's, you know, it's that's the world we live in, and it's what we have to deal with, and it's what we have to talk about. I mean, if we don't talk about these issues, then, you know, then we only have ourselves to blame for what's going on in the world. What's happening in Palestine is just the most horrific crime against humanity. It's just so wrong that those people have been under military occupation for nearly as long as I've been alive. And I'm 45 years old. I don't mind saying that. And, you
well,
know,
longer than you've been. I mean,
longer than I've been
thrown
alive.
Out of their land in 48.
I just don't understand how the United States can continue to support Israel financially and militarily while they continue to subjugate the Palestinian people in ways that are just, you know, beyond reprehensible. How the Israeli government can actually say with a straight face that they are protecting the Israeli people, while they bombard and completely flatten and destroy Palestine, is, you know, just beyond common sense. And, you know, talk about infuriating. And I,
yeah. Those of us who follow it closely really get frustrated. True. Yes.
And, you know, and I feel disappointed. Disappointed is too weak a word, but I feel disappointed in my own country. I'm not ashamed to call myself an American, because it's not the American people that are doing this. It's the government. And
right.
This is a really important point, I think, to make in regards to things going on around the world, where, you know, we're talking about, you know, things happening in the Middle East or in Syria or in Africa. A lot of times the issues that arise where populations are being subjugated to tyrannical dictators, we're talking about the government. We're not talking about the people. The people aren't looking to, you know, genocide themselves, and they're not, you know, and, you know, people in, even people in Israel aren't necessarily looking to destroy the Palestinians. This is a political maneuver by the Zionists, as far as the Palestinians are concerned.
And that's what people have to, you know, really get a grasp on, that the Zionists do not represent the Israelis.
Right.
I mean, as far as the Israelis have enough problems. I mean, they've been doing demonstrations and everything because of their economy. Plus, a lot of them are pro-Palestinian. So, no, it's the Zion entity that is doing all this. But that's like people around the world. They don't hate us as Americans, because, you know, we're talking with them, and they understand that our government is against us also.
It's corrupt.
Yeah, very corrupt. So.
And it's a sad illusion that America, you know, the American government puts itself forward as this, you know, great humanitarian.
I'm learning to hate that word, and only because it has been so misused.
So misused. I mean, I don't think they would even know. I don't think they even understand the meaning of the word humanitarian, to be quite honest.
No, they wouldn't know if it bit them in the butt, which is sort of an interesting visual, isn't it? I wanted to ask you, you know, that this 2012 is a year of transformation and things. What do you see for you in California, actually, where you are, coming in 2013?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Some of the things that are happening for me in 2013 on a small scale, I'm really looking to, in this next year, to get really more involved in my own community, as well as greater involvement in things happening around the world. Now, as far as the world goes, I'm not entirely sure how I will empower myself to be more involved in that area. It might happen through my radio program, which up until this point, I'm kind of jumping subjects here, but up until
That's
this
fine.
Point, I've been doing largely a lot of shows to deal with, I guess sort of human interest stories and things to do with natural health and healing, which is an area that I have a lot of experience in and I do have a lot of passion for. But I kind of see a need to talk about larger issues, and it's probable that I'll be looking to move the show 30 Minutes into more of a political arena.
Okay.
I just think it's just so important to be talking about the much larger issues that are concerned not just to me or just to people in California or just to people in America, but people around the world. Things I see happening after, after the winter solstice and this whole thing with transformation and the end of the Mayan calendar and so forth, you know, to me, this is a great time for transition from
time for beginnings.
Well, a beginnings definitely, but a transition away from sort of really centric thinking, thinking about our own selves and our own you know, just the little area around us, or maybe just even within our own country, and start thinking about ourselves as world citizens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all in this together. When we talk about us all being connected, that's part of that. You know, what's happening in Palestine, it does impact us. What's happening in Syria does impact us. What's happening in Africa impacts us. And we need to be embracing that, and we need to be talking about the issues that are happening in other countries and seeing what we can do to affect change in those countries, just as what they're doing in their country will have an impact on us and will affect change in our own country.
Exactly. We're all interconnected.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
You know, it's not just a spiritual idea or a metaphysical idea, this connection, but it's a physical connection as well. The world is not as big as it used to be, thanks to the digital age. But thanks to the digital age, you know, we have a real opportunity and I think an obligation to affect change around the world.
Yeah,
and that's something that is becoming more and more important to me, and something I'm becoming very passionate about. And I'm gonna do what I can to make a larger impact.
That's wonderful. It is. So on another, speaking of digital this and that, and you know I'm the lowest tech person around. you used to do some movie reviews before Dr. Temple Live, and I went to ask. Have you seen any good film lately, or?
Yes, quite a bit. You know, it's interesting on two fronts. For myself personally, I've been watching quite a number of documentaries lately, and this goes back to what I was just talking about. One of the films I just finished viewing, the end of it today. Have you seen this film called Half the Sky?
Half the Sky.
This is a very important film. I encourage everyone to go out and try to view it. It can be viewed. I think you can view it on Netflix, which is where I saw it. You can also view it on their website, which I believe is halftheskymovement.org. This film, what it does is it's actually started from a book written by two New York Times journalists. And what they saw in their work as New York Times journalists over the years was how often in countries around the world, women and girls are subjugated to the most horrific situations and abuse and, you know, being put down and being pushed to the side and just really horrific things. And it turned, after the book was written, it then became this documentary. And what they did is they invited female celebrities to go to different parts of the world to see what is really going on. And the reason they invited celebrities is because they believe that, you know, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, you know, celebrities, like it or not, do carry a certain amount of cachet, and people do listen to what they have to say.
That's
so,
crying.
You know, if you can use that celebrity to spread the word about what's happening in the world, then that's a good thing. And so there are a number of celebrities. I'm trying to think of some of the women who were in the movie. American Ferrera was one. Meg Ryan was one. Olivia Wilde is in it, and I think there's three others. The movie is in two parts, and in each part they would bring these. Gabrielle Union is in it as well. They would bring these women to places like Africa, India, Somalia. I remember in the show about India. It's so heart-wrenching to hear these stories about how women are forced into prostitution at ages as young as 3 and 4 years old.
Oh,
it is
God.
Beyond disgusting.
Oh.
And not only are they forced into it, but many of them just believe that because of their station in life, that they just sort of accept it, that is what their future is, to be a prostitute for the rest of their lives.
Oh, God, it's just that's the way it is.
It's beyond. And then the story in Somalia was equally as disturbing. Evidently in Somalia, there's a very brutal practice known as FMG, female mutilation of the genitalia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's a tradition to do this to women at a certain age, and they do it without any anesthesia, without any pain blocking whatsoever. They're just, and as young as like 12 and 13 years of age.
Yeah. Now that is something that I have followed on, and a lot of people in the West blame that on Islam. And it has nothing to do with Islam.
It has nothing to do with Islam.
It's not a religious. And it's true that some of the cultures are basically Islamic, but they aren't doing it because of that.
Exactly. No, this is based in tradition, and it's also based in, once again, subjugating women,
right.
Power over women, and taking away, you know, very simple
insecure
things like
men. Really, because they thought that, you know, if they could take the pleasure away from women, the women wouldn't run around on them.
Exactly. Well, not only that, though, but when they do this to women, it causes horrific things to the female's body that when they become pregnant, which they invariably do, and then they attempt to have these children, you know, not to be disgusting, but the opening just simply isn't big enough for children to come through because of all the scar tissue that is formed. And so many women die in childbirth in Somalia. It's horrific. I mean, as many as 10 to 15 women a day are dying in Somalia in childbirth because they simply can't have the child.
And that's not the only country. I mean, there's
no, it's not the only country, but it's one of the ones that's profiled in this film, Half the Sky.
Yeah. Well, this film sounds excellent, though. It's Half the Sky, and you said either at Netflix or movement.org.
Well, no, the website is halftheskymovement.org.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that is the website. Okay. Wow.
So that's one film I just
And
then another one I saw recently, and this is something else that you know, really infuriates me once again about the United States. Do you happen to know this, that in the United States, the only legal way, and it is qualified by law, the only legal way to treat cancer is by radiation, chemotherapy, or cutting, you know, surgery.
No, I did not know that was the only legal way. That's disgusting, too.
I'm sorry?
I said, that's disgusting, too. I did not know
that. It is disgusting. It's the only legal way, and that you cannot go to your doctor and ask for any kind of alternative therapy, no matter what you've heard about it. They cannot treat you with it because they can be sued for it. But, you know, thank God there are people out there that know about alternative therapies for cancer, and believe it or not, there is, in fact, cures for cancer.
Yes, that
cures cancer exists.
Yes.
They are being practiced. They can be found. One way to find them, there's a terrific film out there right now. Once again, this film can be seen on Netflix. That's where I see all my films these days.
Okay.
It's called The Gerson Miracle. The Gerson Miracle is about the work of Dr. Max Gerson. He was a Jewish doctor who escaped from Nazi Germany, who discovered many years ago, back in the 1930s, a cure for cancer. And there is a place that has come out of his work known as the Gerson Institute. It's in San Diego, California. It's currently run by Max Gerson's daughter, Charlotte Gerson. And they have a hospital, but they had to establish the hospital in Tijuana, Mexico, because it would have been illegal to establish it in the United States.
Right. How do you spell Gerson, Michael?
G-E-R-S-O-N. as in Nancy.
Okay, G-E-R-S-O-N. Okay, just like it sounds. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And they have, through the Gerson Institute, people that are interested can find out more information about, you know, what their services and the hospital. And they have a website. I believe it's gersoninstitute.org. They even have a Facebook page. So people who are on Facebook can find them that way as well.
Okay, wonderful. Well, we talked about the film. Before we close, what about what you're reading? I know you're a big reader.
Recently, I just finished reading a book about Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, called The Tumultuous Loves and Lives of Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. And I was really interested in this book because, you know, early on in my schooling days, I was really into studying philosophy. And, of course, Jean-Paul Sartre is right up there in the echelons of that type of study.
Oh, yeah.
And, but I have to say, in reading this book, those two people were, I don't know, they really pushed the boundaries of efficacy in the way they treated other people, because essentially they were very duplicitous in their dealings with other people. And in many ways, I feel like my estimation of what I thought of him has really kind of declined after reading the book, because
wow.
they were really quite horrible. I mean, they lied so much that lying became their truth. And they lied to everybody they knew. They lied to their family members. They lied to their friends. They lied to their lovers. The only people they were honest with was each other. They told each other the complete truth, but they lied to everybody else. And they were manipulative. I don't know. It was a fascinating read. I definitely recommend it to anyone who wants to read a really interesting narrative, but at the same time, just be ready to
have your bubble burst,
blown apart. I mean, if you had a bubble in the first place about them, you know.
Right, you may not have.
But by far, probably one of the most interesting books I have read this year.
Okay, well, interesting really counts.
Yes.
So, what do you think about this 12 Awakening?
Well, here's my thing about awakening, and what I've come to realize what that word really means, for me anyway. Awakening it's not about, you know, becoming becoming a light being, or, you know, suddenly having magical abilities, or I don't know, any number of other things that people think are associated with awakening. Yes, you know, maybe some people, when they become awakened, do gain greater knowledge, and maybe some do come into psychic abilities. And that's great if that is the experience for those folks. But for me, awakening is dropping the illusions that many of us have been living with for our whole lives. And whatever those illusions are, whether they're illusions about the country we live in, illusions about the lives we're leading ourselves, about where we are in our own lives. To me, awakening is just being, becoming more aware of truth in its purest sense, and, you know, really looking below the surface of everything around you, and coming to the realization that, just like Gandhi said, and I've said this before, that change does begin with you, or with ourselves. If we want the world to change, then we have to change. We have to change our thinking. We have to change the way we do things. And, you know, we just have to make a change across the board. And
yeah.
To me, that's what it means to be awakened.
Okay, no, that totally makes sense. One more question. What about, you've lived in California now for a while, and before that you lived in Florida and Illinois. You know, we all hear all this glamorous talk about California. Is it really that different, Michael?
It's not really all that different. People are people wherever you go. And, you know, it's funny, one thing, the real thing that's different about California is it really does, at least where I live, have the best weather in the country.
Okay.
That is the biggest difference. I mean, the weather here is really quite temperate. When the rest of the country is boiling hot or freezing cold, we're always hovering right around 70 degrees.
Okay, that does make a difference. But other than that, you haven't run into so much glamour that you can't stand it or anything.
No.
Well, I suppose in a way that's good. But, okay, Michael, is there anything else you'd like to tell people before you come on next week asking the questions?
I would just say, I would just really encourage everyone out there to do whatever you can in your own communities, in your own lives, to be more proactive and to work at making bridges around the world, to make this world a smaller place for everyone concerned, because that is the way we're going to improve the world.
Okay. Well said. Very well said. So I thank you.
Thank you.
Back here same time next Wednesday.
All right. We look forward to it. We'll see you all then.
Thanks, Michael. Bye-bye. Good night.
Bye-bye.